Right, Eva, many thanks for the introduction. And yeah, I'm unfortunately already leaving this place already tomorrow, which is terrible, but there are two very well knowledgeable gentlemen gonna stay until the next, and until the end of the week, and this is actually Boris Novak and Denis Sexty, whom I'd like to mention, who have worked and are working with me on this topic I'm going to talk about. And that's also, let me just switch this on. Oh, no, let's take the, what is it, the crowd control. So there's also two more students, Maximilian and Jan, working now on the MetaWave turbulence project. And I'd also like to mention Christian Schepper, who has done a large part of the work I'm going to talk about today. And he's left for Cambridge to work on biophysics. And I also like to mention Jürgen Berges from Darmstadt, from High Energy Physics Field Theory, who has actually brought me to this topic at exactly this place 3 years ago. So, yeah, because Ebert had this mentioned in the beginning, it's not, is it visible? I have to show this picture.
Like,
so let's
turn it off.
Middle one.
Turn it off.
Middle one? The first one you came to, that's the one that.
Yeah, okay.
That's a little better.
It's okay. So I have to show this. This is about 10 minutes before.
There's some knots to your left.
No, there's some over here.
Okay.
Oh, this turns it on.
Yep.
All right, good.
Perfect.
You found
so
it.
So somewhere 10 or 20 minutes before I knew that we were flying over the Hudson Bay, I saw this sort of kilometer, a big piece of ice breaking off, and I saw these white stripes, and I just was really wondering what they meant, yeah, because it looked like it was on the water. Now I know what it is, and I had to show you, so it's just fun. Now, apart from that, I hope you had all no turbulence on your flights. Okay, so let me start. Because I'm somehow, a large part of the work we are doing is more closer connected to ultra-cold atoms and ultra-cold atomic gases. Let me show a few nice pictures in the beginning before we come to slides with slightly more formula. So ultra-cold atomic gases have been now around for at least 20 years, since 15 years in the form of Bose-Einstein condensation. Now, Bose-Einstein condensates now can be produced down to the nanokelvin regime, and just you just have to realize that this is two orders of magnitude further away from our room temperature. Sorry, this is in German, but you will understand that.
Just one.
From our room temperature, then a supernova nova is away in the opposite direction. So there are these lowest sort of coldest systems in the world, much colder than the microwave background in open space, and so much colder than anywhere in the universe outside the Earth. Now, another nice thing to know is that the pressures in these experiments, here's the glass cell, so they have their condensate of a few microns here in the center, about 5 millimeters away from room temperature. So all these 9 orders of magnitude are just bridged within 5 millimeters. And in order to have that, you need a pressure which is approximately the same as the pressure on the surface of the moon, the atmospheric pressure. Right, now, Bose-Einstein condensation, I mean, you all know what it is. When you take, of course you take bosons, you have to take bosons for that. Now you increase the phase space density, essentially that's the important bit. And once the phase space density exceeds about 2.5, 2.6 in an ideal gas, then you get condensation, and that means essentially you need to make the Fermi de Broglie wavelengths on the order of the interparticle spacing in the system, and then you have overlapping wave packets and they can get into coherent phase relations and you get Bose-Einstein condensation. And I'd also like to briefly show this picture, it's always shown, just because I'm gonna show later on these bimodal distributions. One has to remind oneself that these are expansion pictures, so after a ballistic expansion of such a Bose-Einstein condensate, showing essentially the momentum or velocity distribution of the gas before the expansion. So when there's a peak in the center, that means there's a condensate of particles which could not just couldn't travel out, whereas here the thermal cloud has formed this Gaussian second part of the distribution. And what was important at in the beginning was that this central bit showed reminiscences of the anisotropy of the trapping geometry, of the trapping configuration of the condensate, whereas the thermal cloud around here just expands to a spherical cloud. So that was a clear sign that they had actually produced these condensates. Right, Bose-Einstein condensation. Now, because we are, of course, here mainly interested in turbulence, let me now show some pictures related to that in some way. What we see in such condensates. Now, these pictures are already, again, just about 10 years old from the labs of Wolfgang Ketteler at MIT. And he was really, as my former boss, Keith Burnett, said at the time, well, when the king goes to war, yeah, so he was really the perfectionist. So he had the cleanest pictures after other people trying to produce one vortex and maybe two, and one had even three. Now he had right away 40 of them, yeah, starting this business. So what is shown here is again an expansion picture of such a condensate. So in the beginning he stirs his cloud with a laser, then he waits a while, and then he switches off the trap that the cloud can expand, and then in the end takes a picture of one slice of the condensate such that he could visualize with his laser absorption technique these density dips formed beforehand by the vortices. And now you nicely see these are different hold times before he switches off, so he can sort of follow up what happens in between the stirring and the switching off. So in the beginning there's maybe a turbulent state, one doesn't know. They didn't analyze that at the time. And then after a sufficiently long hold time, he has very nice Abrikosov lattices forming in these systems before in the end the whole thing decays through three body recombination processes.
Can I just comment?
Yes.
So the fact that E shows such a very nice triangular lattice,
yeah,
suggests to me that there's a fair amount of damping in the system. In addition to the superfluid, there's some very strong dissipative mechanisms, because actually the energy difference between the triangular and square lattice here are very, very small.
Yeah.
So in fact, if it were just a pure superfluid, it'd be very hard to reach that state.
Okay.
Because that state has had to have a lot of dissipation happen in a second to get there.
Yeah. So this is all these loss processes.
But it doesn't have to be dissipation in the sense of a normal fluid. It can be the wiggles on the vortex lines themselves radiate phonons away. That's the mechanism that I'm suggesting from my calculation. So I'm just saying,
as long as those wiggles can exit the system.
Well, I certainly can in this case.
So sorry.
Okay, there have been some analysis at the time that these actually lattices can form, but I'm not aware of that. They really also experimentally they didn't really analyze this intermediate stage. What's precisely happening? So there's interesting things to come maybe. Now let me show a few pictures of some more recent experiments from the group of Brian Anderson at Tucson, Arizona. What they're interested in is, in the first place, just a few vortices, and especially kind of scattering of vortex pairs of some kind of disturbances in the trap, which you can't see in this place. So they have these vortices traveling along. They produce them along one axis. They travel along, and then there's here somewhere there's a there's a maximum of the potential. And now what they look at is how they are actually it's not quite true what I'm saying. So what they produce is just a flow, and then they have this the singular point, and then they watch how these sort of vortex anti-vortex pairs are created behindhand. Behind that, and they are then traveling around the trap and then come back to the first point.
Which way are the pairs moving, left or right?
Yeah, this is the picture they give for their.
I mean, is there a sequence of pictures from the left to the right?
Oh yeah, this is earlier times. This is later times. Yeah. So you see, sort of here they are produced behind this obstacle.
Yes.
And then they travel out and then come back. Yeah?
And so the obstacle is just the higher density in the
yeah,
middle.
Yeah, exactly.
But when they come back, they travel through the middle.
Yes, yes. Exactly as it's shown here. That's what they observe. Anyway, so this is again just an illustration of what is possible. I had a von Karman street found on the internet, which I really liked. So that's seen from a NASA satellite. But let's not dwell on that because I'm not going to talk about it. I'd just like to show you some examples of sort of present-day experiments concerning vortices. And here's the third one, which is the closest connector, in the closest way connected to turbulence, because that is from Vandelay's Bagnatis group, and I suppose you know all that very well. So he had a paper out in 2009 where they showed these pictures, and then they give these illustrations saying that what they see here should be these kind of vortex tangles, maybe. Yeah, giving some reminiscence of what you would expect on theoretical grounds. So here are some calculations from Natalia Berloff showing the evolution of vortex tangles in the GPE. So this I just flash again. I don't want to make any statement about this experiment so far. Okay, so now given the situation that you are sort of at the brink of getting into a regime where you can study the dynamics not only of a few vortices and their creation, but also maybe a more complicated dynamics of vortices, vortex lines, and Bose-Einstein condensates. I think we are at a really interesting and exciting time, especially for the topic we are talking on at this conference. Now let me switch essentially and come to the topic I'm and the questions I'm going to talk about, namely the question of matter wave turbulence in the Bose-Einstein condensate as derived from quantum field theoretic approaches. Now let me start slowly and introduce the variables I'm going to talk about. So of course we are looking at bosonic quantum fields. We will have low order correlation functions and are going to be interested only in these sort of first order. So there's of course a field expectation value, a mean field, whose square gives the density of the condensate, and that sort of picture should sort of refer to the central peak in these expansion plots. Then there is the two-point function, which essentially can be seen when this part is subtracted as the density of non-condensed atoms. So you could also do this by just taking out the mean field of the operator and, according to Gogol-Yubov, keep a fluctuating field and then calculate the two-point functions of this fluctuating field, which is essentially something like the connected two-point function or cumulant in second order. Now, this was still diagonal in space. Of course, what we will have to be interested in is the full density matrix, one-body density matrix, which has both dependencies on x and y, and which has information, for example, in its Fourier transform for a homogeneous system about the momentum distribution in the gas. Or, if you like, for the first order phase coherence, which is essentially the same in real space. Of course, there will be also other components where there's a phi operator here, some anomalous density matrix, which I'm not going to talk about here now. But we will respect these, we will consider these, of course, as well. Now, so these are the correlation functions we have to be interested in, and why I will argue later on. But of course, it's clear it's the lowest order ones. These are the ones which are also sort of the first one has to look at. Now, dynamics. To first order, you get the well-known Gross-Pideyevsky dynamics. What you start with is the exact Hamiltonian of the system. Of course, there's a free part. There's a quantum interaction. And this interaction potential is given essentially by the interatomic collisions. And I will say in a moment how one parameterizes them in order to get to the Gross-Pideyevsky equation. Now, from this Hamiltonian, one can derive the GPE easily by taking the von Neumann equation for any arbitrary operator, that is, simply by commuting this operator with a Hamiltonian, you get the time evolution of the expectation value of this operator. And taking for the operator, the single field operator, you immediately get to the Gross-Gudievsky equation. Or at least you get to the, you get, first of all, you get to the exact equation of motion for this first order moment. And that exact equation of motion will have, on the right-hand side, an expectation value of a product of three field operators, which is simply left by commuting the field operator with this quadratic term. And now the GPE results as the sort of first-order cumulative approximation, where you factorize this third-order correlation function into a product of three first-order correlation functions, so of three mean fields, which is written down here. Also, what I've done here is to approximate the potential, sort of to Born order by a contact potential such that all what is left is a some constant, some coupling constant, and all the fields are evaluated at the same space coordinate and also time coordinate. Okay, that's the GPE, which you all know very well. For ultra-cold gases, this is a very important equation, and let me just mention what the typical quantities are which enter this equation for ultra-cold gases. Of course, you can write this coupling constant, at least in three dimensions, in terms of scattering length, A, which so is a length parameter times some constant. And this scattering length for the ultra-cold atoms is on the order of nanometers. At the same time, the typical bulk density in these condensates is on the order of 10 to the 14 to 15 per cubic centimeters in three dimensions again, such that you can easily calculate that the ratio of scattering length to interatomic distance or to third power less diluteness parameter is on the order of 10 to the 5, right? And 10 to the minus 5. And the fact that this is such a small quantity establishes that these ultra-cold gases are essentially very dilute systems, and the Gross-Gudievsky equation is expected to form a really good approximation to describe these to mean field order. Okay, so much should be enough for now. Now, when we would like to look at turbulence, at matter wave turbulence, we would not like to do what we what we later will do as well, we would not like to stay with the Gross-Gudievsky equation and simulate the dynamics. No, we would like to analyze the fluctuations of the field in the system in order to obtain results for the power laws which are expected in such a turbulent stationary situation. And for that, we have to go beyond mean field order eventually, but also we have to go first beyond the dynamics simply for the first order moment and look at higher order moments. And still within the mean field approximation, that leads us at the next order to the mean field Hartree-Fock Bogle-Lubov equations, which can be obtained again by the von Neumann equation as an example, by simply plugging in the operator products. And then on the right-hand side of these equations, do some mean field factorization of this well-known form. And so on. You could, of course, go on and go beyond mean field and get a full Born, Bogle-Lubov, Green, Kirkwood, Ivan hierarchy in order to take into account, account higher and higher correlation functions. Now,
so you can write down a classical equation for the fluctuations, like the Gross-Gudievsky equation?
You can write down equations for the classical fluctuations. Of course, to first, when you do this hierarchy, you get the full hierarchy if you did it exactly for the quantum fluctuations as well. And then you have to know what to take, what essentially to leave out in order to have classical fluctuations only present. Let me say a little bit to that later on, but that's also no problem at all. No? But you can do that. So now,
is it different from the Castor? You know, Castor in Paris.
Castor and Dom.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the Castor and Dom. This is another subtlety which is discussed there. I mean, the problem is always when you take a non-relativistic field. Strictly speaking, there is no coherent state because there is never a superposition of different particle numbers. even if you had sort of an open system, you would always have, you could never have a coherent state. This would be a mixture of different particle numbers with the environment. And in the end, you can always prove that there's no expectation value of the field operator. And this problem is resolved in this ansatz by just reformulating it slightly such that the full number conservation is kind of respected. This ends up in a formulation where you do not have first order fields, but only second order fields as lowest correlation functions. The results will be the same up to corrections of 1 over the particle number in the condensate. So you can do that alternatively. I would not like to respect this problem too much now, because it's going to be irrelevant on these classical scales. It's going to be a relevant problem if you go down to single particles, which we never do. Okay, now I'm mentioning this BBGK-VAR hierarchy here, but I'm not going to dwell on it further, because I would like to present you with a different approach to calculate the dynamics of the higher order correlation functions beyond mean field order, and that is dynamical quantum field theory, essentially on the basis of the Schwinger-Keldysh approach as applied to path integrals. Now again, we have a Bose field. The quantities we are going to look at, besides the mean field, which is the same, are two-point correlation functions, which are now also two-point functions in time, and automatically need some definition of the time ordering. Here's what we use is the usual convention that you order the later time to the left with this operator T. So this just introduces the quantity that you know what I'm going to talk about here in the following. Now, let me maybe at this first step skip a little bit all the field theory steps which lead us to the equations and start with the equations, so to say the results first. So as the alternative to the BBGK-VAR hierarchy for the full correlation functions, or if you like also for the cumulants, if you rewrite them, we write down such a Dyson equation, which is sort of the lowest order Schwinger-Dyson equation, where there's now here the inverse of this Green's function, which I just introduced, of the full propagator. Here's a free Green's function, which I'll define in a second. And then there will be a self-energy function, which includes all the effects of the higher order correlation effects we have to be interested in beyond mean field order. Now, let me here first define this g0 to the minus 1. What you do in path integral theory, you have always an action function L, which is the time integral of the Lagrangian. And for this Bose field, it has, natural free term, where there's the one-body Hamiltonian, which includes the kinetic term and maybe external potentials, if you like. And then there's a first-order time derivative for these non-relativistic fields. Besides these, there's, of course, then the interaction term exactly in the same way as in the Hamiltonian, now with the minus sign. Now, this action defines my g0 to the minus 1, and in this way, essentially, the free part of the model. Now, when you take this Schwinger-Dyson equation and multiply it from the right with g, then you get to the Kalanov-Bain equation for the two-point function, which is readily the dynamic equation we are going to be interested in. So there's here an operator acting on g, and this operator has a time derivative in here. So it's a time evolution equation. It's a first order differential equation in time. And all the other terms make it an integral differential equation for the dynamics. So there's a term which then results from g with g to the minus 1 g, which conserves the commutator. And here on the right-hand side will be the essential information from the scattering, from the correlations. This is the scattering integral, very similar to then in the kinetic approximation, the Boltzmann scattering integral. Right. Now the question is, how do we get to this Schwinger-Dyson equation? Because to write down, everyone can do that. And it's exact, but that's not of any help. So we will have to know how to approximate the self-energy function. Now, what we are doing in our approach is we take the so-called two-particle irreducible effective action, which has been first introduced in the 60s in condensed matter theory and then later on rediscovered by the high-energy physicists in the 70s. It was also at that time that this name was coined. Here it's called the phi functional and phi derivable theories. Now what this is it's like in classical mechanics, you write down an action instead of your equations of motion. And because we don't have classical theory but quantum theory, we need to write down an effective action which takes into account quantum fluctuations and which is now a functional of all the, in this construction, a functional of all the observables we are actually interested in. So it's the first order correlation function and the second order correlation function. You could take only the first order, that would be the first thing to do. That's what most people would do when they work in this approach. That gives you the one particle reducible effective action. Now this two particle, I say in a minute what that means, can be written down in the following way. There's, again, it starts with a classical action functional. Then it has some what you call one-loop terms or mean field terms or saddle-point approximation terms, which have the usual trace log form, which does come from integrating out the Gaussian order, the path integral. And then there's all the interesting bit, which you, in the first place, just have to write down as the rest, but which you know from this field theoretic approach how to write it down in terms of your quantities, which are here the arguments of that functional. And for this two-particle irreducible effective action, you know that you can write it down as closed, that is, vacuum diagrams of your functions, which are two-particle irreducible. That means on opening two lines, all these diagrams do not fall apart. And the reason why this is 2PI is that because one can show that the first order derivative of this part here, all the bubbles in the end, they give you the self-energy. Taking the first order derivative means nothing else but opening a line. So for all those who are, I think you're all familiar with the graph description, this is just it's just a way how to close these tensors. I don't know. I'm happy to talk more about that, but I thought.
You can assume we either know it or we won't understand it.
Okay. I mean, if you don't, then it's
very much you want to phrase.
So I should say one thing. So that the colors already indicated. Yeah, the colors. A line is a propagator, and it has two ends, and the two ends are the two arguments of the propagator, x and y. Okay, and the black dots are the vertices defined by in my classical action, which are the interactions between four fields. So all my vertices here have four ends. The red crosses are fields attached to these. Okay. Now, such a diagram simply means that you take all the arguments at that point the same and sum over them. So there's an integration. So it's nothing else but multiplying all these matrices and one and vectors with each other, and taking maybe the trace in the end in order to get a scalar. So here you take the trace, you take the trace here, you multiply from the left and right with the vector, and you get a scalar. That's it, okay? Everything else, you just have to believe me that it comes out like this, okay? And but, yeah?
You have a small arbiter, maybe?
Let me say something to the expansion. So what this approach shows me is that I can write down the expansion in terms of these quantities, and naturally what you get is these loop orders. Yeah? So that's all you can do. You can write down higher and higher loop diagrams. So you could say, okay, your expansion parameter is the number of loops, and what is connected to that is the number of bare vertices in here. Okay, you could do that, but you have to be careful. I mean, you can say, okay, the coupling is small, so that might be a good idea to truncate after such an order, but you always have to be careful because the functions in here are the full propagators. And these full propagators, in the end, will be given by taking this Hamiltonian principle of the action, as you do in Hamiltonian mechanics as well. Yeah, so that it's actually self-consistently determined from the action itself. Yeah, so what you can divert out easily from the equation is that each of these propagators, strictly speaking, is already an infinite sum to all orders in the coupling, which you plugged in here as a bare coupling. And so you are immediately masked with a straight perturbation theory. Yeah? So that is actually also different to the case where there's no G here, and you had here three propagators, G naught. Then there's no coupling in the free propagator, and then you have a perturbative expansion. Yeah? But the important thing is that you go one order higher, you have self-consistency for the propagators, and in this way, this expansion is more a formal thing. Okay? Anyway, I will show you in a minute that this is what you do all the time. So if you truncate here, you actually get your Boltzmann equation back. Yeah? Because in the Boltzmann equation, you also know there's on the right-hand side, there's powers of the density n, which is the one you determine on the left-hand side. I mean, of course, one has to argue about how self-consistent that is, but at least there you already formally see that it also has the same structure. Okay, so what we have to do in the end, given that expansion, is we have to truncate somewhere, or maybe even resum in finite orders and sort of take out certain classes of diagrams, and then take the stress of the derivative, and we get back to our equation of motion, and it's got exactly that form with the self-energy given by the derivative of this series. Yeah? So that's the approach. Now, let me stop saying too much more about this at the moment. But I should say one more important bit. Why does one actually do that? So you could ask, why do you take G? Why don't you take, for example, a three-point function in here or a four-point? You could do that. You could go further and write down effective actions for as many high-order correlation functions as you like. Of course, the right-hand side will be more and more complicated. But you can do that, and there's formal ways to derive these NPI effective actions. I do that because this is the lowest thing you can do in order to make sure that at any of these truncations in diagrams on the right-hand side, these equations conserve energy automatically. I mean, of course, you can do the lower order approach, 1PI, but then you will have to fiddle around with energy conservation. And you have to really make sure that you conserve energy by your approximation, and that might be non-trivial. And that's exactly the same problem as in the BBGKY hierarchy, that you can go beyond Hartree-Fock-Bober-Lyubov, but then you have to make sure that your truncation doesn't violate energy conservation and maybe other important conservation laws, like in our case, the number density approximations. Right, so this is sort of, this has been the crucial point why people went back to look at these functions, at this theory introduced in the 70s to actually consider dynamics. Yeah? Over two decades, it's only been used for static physics, and now since about 10 years, it's been intensely used to study dynamics. I mean, one's got to be careful, apart from, of course, the long history in Kalanov-Bain equations, which has been constantly followed. However, even there, people only now got back to this approach, got back to actually evaluating the equations because computers have become powerful enough to do that. Now, let me come to the question of scaling, because we are talking about turbulence. We will have in mind a time evolution of a many-body system from some non-equilibrium to some equilibrium, and in between, so I had the big luck to see this myself, it's Beehive geyser in Yellowstone, and you have some turbulence in between if you're lucky. Okay, now how do you usually look at turbulence? And I would like to switch back to an approach which Grisha has already started yesterday to introduce, namely the wave turbulent approach, or actually introduced yesterday, the wave turbulent approach to this cascade, what does it mean? Yeah? So in the cascade, you have some momentum space transport, so this is supposed to be sort of a spherical transport in momentum space. You have some pump at low k, and you have some sink at high, somewhere out there at high k. And in between, you have some radial flux if everything is isotropic, essentially most importantly, if the interactions are isotropic. Now, what you look at is the balance equation for the radial flux, so that the time derivative of the radial density, as given by the divergence of the radial particle or quasi-particle flux in this case. Now, what you usually do in wave turbulence is you take the Boltzmann equation, kinetic theory, and write down for this right-hand side simply a scattering integral multiplied here with k to the b minus 1 in order to have a radial transport. And then you ask this right-hand side to be 0. And given that condition non-changing stationary occupation of that particle shell, so there's what you can show also then is that there's no non-local scattering in and out of this shell, but there's only radial flux, and the influx is the same as the outflux, you derive your scaling, the scaling of the function n, which is described by this equation. Now, of course, there are two approaches. So this is one, to ask that it's 0, and the other approach is to ask for a k-independent flow or flux density q. And in the following, because that is easier, I will argue about a k-independent flux density, although I'd like to point out that the first approach we have chosen on the basis of our dynamics is the other one, to ask for the zeros of the scattering integral. But in this way, we can easily calculate the scaling by asking this flux density, which is given by the scattering integral, to not scale under a rescaling of n. And you do this in the following way. So, of course, as you know, there's sort of momentum energy conservation and the usual Boltzmann factor and the T matrix squared. Now, you can have a look at how these properties rescale when you rescale your k's. Now, let me start down here. I assume that my function n, my distribution, scales as k to the minus zeta. So then I get here a power of minus 3 zeta from this Boltzmann term, the fourth order term scales. I get a minus 2. From this kinetic term, if I assume that the dispersion is quadratic, and I get k to the minus d from the momentum delta function, and I get k to the 3d from these integral measures. Now, taking this not to scale at all, as it would be the case in our cold gases, because you just have a constant, the scattering length a, there's no k dependence at these low energies, you can easily work out what the scaling zeta will be in the end. Namely, what you have to do is you have to add all these up and also take into account that you have here a k to the d minus 1 in front of j times a k from this divergence in order to know if you want this q to be k independent. Yeah? So you have k to the d minus 1 plus 1, which I've written down here, d minus 1 plus 1. And then I just add up these numbers, 3d minus d minus 2 minus 3z is 0. Now, from that you easily derive that zeta scales at d to the minus 2 thirds. Okay, that is weak wave turbulence and is known since a long time. That's what follows from the Boltzmann equation for such a dilute gas.
Zeta of is the exponent or something. What now?
I forgot to write this down. So this is missing. So I assume that n of k scales like k to the minus zeta. Okay? This is what I plug in. And then you see here there are three nk's down here, that is minus 3 zeta. And that's it.
This is Fourier space.
That is Fourier space K. So these are occupation numbers. Yeah.
Right.
These are occupation numbers. So in our case, it would be something like psi beta K, psi K, expectation value. I didn't come to the connection yet, but I just wanted to show that first because that's sort of known from kinetic theory. All right. Now, that gives an exponent. Now, let me come back to the field theoretic approach. Now, we don't have a Boltzmann equation in the first place, but we have our dynamic equation, which I wrote down before, the Carroll of Bain equation, including cell energy. Now, here I write down the same Carroll of Bain equation in a slightly different way, as it appears now when it is reduced to exactly these quantities n of k, which are the expectation values of the square of the field operators psi dega k, psi k. Yeah, so that's just the number operator in mode k. And the expectation value gives me n of k. And I can relate these to my functions g I had before, which were time order derivatives. But you can relate these through the following functions, namely f and rho. F is the expectation value of these field operators. Now, sorry, here's A and B. So A and B count like psi 1 is equal to psi, psi 2 is equal to psi dega. I just go to a basis where I take the field and its complex or Hermitian conjugate. So, but what you see is you can define two functions, namely one function where you have an anticommutator, so you have a symmetric sum of phi ax, phi by, plus phi by, phi ax. And the second possibility is that you have a commutator. Now, how do these come about? And I think I didn't write it down here. But when you take g, ab, which is, of xy, which is the expectation value of the time order product of psi a and psi b, x and psi b of y, where now we should be aware that as x is a four vector, depending on some spatial coordinate and time, which I call x naught, then you can write down this time ordering in a way that you say, okay, theta of x naught minus y naught times psi a x psi b y. That means x naught is later than y naught, or the other way around, theta of y naught minus x naught times the expectation value of psi b of y psi a of x. That's essentially the definition of the time ordering. But once you're here, you can easily combine these symmetrically and antisymmetrically and write down half of the commutator psi a of x psi b of y. Anticommutator, so the symmetric sum. Minus I over 2 times I times the commutator psi a of x psi b of y. And then you need, in order to have the time ordering in there, you need a sine function, signum function here, sgn of x naught minus y naught, which is plus 1 when x naught is greater than y naught, and minus 1 when x naught is smaller than y, right? So in this way, you can write this function g, which is time ordered, as a combination of these independent functions f and rho, which I wrote down here. And be reminded that in equilibrium, when you are near a thermal state, these two functions, now written in Fourier space with respect to frequency and momentum, so that's relative, that's the Fourier transform in the relative coordinates x minus y for a homogeneous system, are related by such a fluctuation dissipation relation. And you can prove that using the Kupo formula that there's here just a factor in between, which is given by the occupation number, which for such a quantum gas is the Bose-Einstein function as a function of some frequency multiplied by this rho. Now, this also brings you to the interpretation of these two functions, namely that the rho is essentially the spectral function which defines which modes are available in the system, whereas f is the statistical function which multiplies the spectral function in equilibrium with the Bose-Einstein factor and therefore says how these modes are occupied.
It's in equilibrium only.
That's only in equilibrium, yeah. Yeah, that's important. So this is only to give you some hint on what these functions mean. Now, in non-equilibrium, what we are interested in, and especially in these stationary non-thermal states, you expect that it's, at least you expect that it's, this is not automatically the case. And that's a different question, of course. When you have kinetic theory, you know immediately that's exactly what you've plugged in. Yeah, so the Boltzmann approximation relies on the fact that these two functions are related in this way. However, then there is a quasi-particle occupation in between, which is non-trivial, and it's not simply given this by this thermal function. But still, there is still some relation when you're even in these turbulent situations. Anyway, I would like to stress, however, that this is not automatically the case out of equilibrium. So we have, in general, two independent functions which enter my dynamic equations. And here they are, entering as f and rho. I've written this now here again in full momentum space. This is, so this is, again, a full momentum where I have Fourier transformed the relative time coordinate, and this time derivative is with respect to the absolute time coordinate. So if you take the time plane of such two-point functions like t and t prime, so let's take f of t comma t prime, just the time arguments, then let's call it x naught and y naught. Sorry, otherwise you're confused. X naught and y naught, then small t will be this direction. T is x naught plus y naught over 2, whereas omega comes from the Fourier transform in this direction. So it gives omega parameterizes the dependence in Fourier space. Along the relative direction. Okay, so that's m rho in here, and then for sigma you can do a similar decomposition in this way that you have again a time ordering, and you can write sort of the singularity you can pull into such a signal function, and you have some f sigma rho and some sigma sigma f and sigma rho terms. Okay, so now this is what you get out of the field theoretic approach. Now, to lowest order, you can take only the diagram I've shown you before. So it's this so-called basketball diagram. That's of second order in the coupling. You cut one line, and you are ending up with this sunset diagram for the self-energy. That's the lowest order, non-trivial, non-mean field approximation you can do to these dynamic equations. And this is I should write down, here's again the action. I wrote it down. So it's this diagram which gives you this part to sigma. Actually, there's also a contribution from here, but that goes into Hartley-Fock, so that's still mean field. Right. Yeah. And now with this approximation, we are now already very close to what the Boltzmann approximation does, namely. And you already see, I mean, this is of second order in the coupling, and that is the same order as I'll go back here to the scattering integral, as you have here. So my coupling here is T, it's actually in our case then K independent, and the second order coupling is exactly the two vertices you have in this diagram. And then when you now take these dynamic equations in the form you have them here, take that approximation, then you can argue via a number of intermediate steps which include Markovian approximation, a quasi-particle ansatz, and other details. You can actually re-derive the Boltzmann equation from here. Yeah, so what we expect is that when we analyze these equations with respect to scaling, we again arrive at the Boltzmann result I've shown you I've introduced you to before. And actually, that's what we precisely do. We make an ansatz for our functions f and rho for their scaling. So you have here different scaling exponents. You have, first of all, a scaling exponent z, like in critical phenomena, which distinguishes between the scaling in p naught and peak. Then you have minus twos, which you need already for the anti-Euclidean convention. And then Kappa and Eta describe the different scalings of these functions f and rho. And now, once you have these, then looking a bit closer at your functions here, then you can find that that you can actually derive the scaling of this density, which is just the normal correlation function of psi dagger psi. You can derive it here from the scaling of this function f, and this is what comes out in the end. Without that, I go now into the details. So this is kind of consistent scaling of these scalings up here.
The what?
Scaling.
Oh, S is the scaling factor. So what you ask is, assume you rescale the momenta and frequencies by S and S to the Z. How does the function rescale? And then you can derive from that essentially the power law in the arguments P. Yeah? So if you have, for example, if you have n,
oh, I see. So
n of sk,
if you want to know n of
s to the minus theta n of k, then you find from this that n must scale with k to the minus theta.
Yes, yeah. Right, fine. So this is a more complete argument for what theta should be.
Yes. So this is the full dynamical scaling ansatz you would do within this approach. Now let me know. Let's go through all the details now.
Gross Pinayowski with
that's the model
order Hartree-Fock terms.
Plus, no, yeah, and now what is important is not only plus Hartree-Fock, that would be that diagram.
Plus the next
plus
order.
The next order, which gives you the scattering in the system. So in order to have collisions, which lead out of the mean field regime, you need to take into account more, as you do in the Boltzmann approach as well.
So it's the scaling law if you have scattering out of the system.
Absolutely.
That's where
that's what you always have to look at because we look at scattering.
Back into the mean field term and you just get another mean field equation.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, that's actually a very important point. So in order to have anything which has to do with this stationary scaling loss in a fully interacting system, you need to go beyond mean field theory.
Right.
As you do in any kinetic scattering theory as well.
5 minutes.
Okay, I'll do that. Now, so when you do that, what we do is we plug in these scaling approaches in our dynamic equation and ask for this right-hand side to vanish. Then we do some integral transforms called Zakharov transforms, which I won't show here, and we get exactly to the result I've already argued before, the d minus 2/3, okay, to that order of approximation. And there's also a second solution, which is theta is equal d, which corresponds not to a constant quasi-particle flux is here, but to a constant energy flux. That's also well known from wave turbulence theory that there are two solutions like that. Actually, there's also two solutions here. There's the interthermal equilibrium, there's always the thermal solution, and then there's the trivial flat solution, which is sort of the second one. Now, now comes the important extra bit, which is always what I'm going to present you is about. Yeah? That comes now. So, sorry if you have. Let me point out the main thing. Now, I said before that to Boltzmann order and wave turbulence order, we have only that diagram. But I also showed you that we have many more diagrams in the series of the 2pi effective action. And in principle, if we could add them all up, we would have the exact theory. Of course, that's what we can't do. But what we can do is we can go, first of all, to higher order, so take into account more. That would give us a kind of a higher order Boltzmann theory. But what we can also do, and that is the nice thing about that approach, is we can resum certain classes of diagrams. And one class we can most easily resum is bubble chains. And that is defined here. Yeah? We end up with a self-energy which has one bare vertex and one resum vertex. And this resum vertex is defined by the bare vertex, which I write here with such a dashed line, plus a single bubble. Now, if you introduce, if you plug in now the left-hand side on the right side, then you see what you generate is bubble sums. So you find that the full vertex is the bare one plus the first order bubble plus the second order bubble plus so on, okay? All to infinite order. And then you can already imagine that when you do that, you can actually write down an integral equation, or actually I have written down an integral equation for it here, which you can solve in terms of a geometric series. Now this leads us to the following. Doing this approach leads us to this Riesz vertex, of which we can actually calculate the scaling. And I've written down here again in the Boltzmann language, I've written down how this vertex now scales. Yeah, so our rescaled our Riesz vertex gives us a momentum-dependent T matrix, and that T matrix has the following form. It has in the numerator this constant which we had before, and in the denominator it has a sum of two terms, a one, which is the becomes important whenever you have kinetic scaling with wave turbulence, and then an additional term which goes with a coupling times k to the d minus 2, and you can argue easily that for dimensional reasons you need here d minus 2 times the occupation number of the mode k. Right? And now you can see that once this occupation number becomes large as compared to the inverse of this prefactor here, the second term in the denominator will take over and change and give us a scaling of k. Yeah, once it becomes large such that you can neglect the 1, it's a scaling function again. And you have you get in the end to a different scaling in your analysis. And let me just summarize what it's going to be. Yeah, what we have here is d minus 2 times, then inverse 2 minus d plus zeta, zeta from n. And I have to add this simply to our analysis before with a factor of 2, because this is a t squared, okay, is equal to 0. And if you do the calculation, you get to zeta is equal to d plus 2 instead of d minus 2/3. That's the result.
You call this a kinetic Boltzmann equation?
Sorry about this line, which I should have erased.
Okay.
But actually, as a matter of fact, although we are not kinetic, so there's spectral functions which are not anymore singular peaks when we do all the analysis. They are so sharply, we expect them to be so sharply peaked at zero that it doesn't matter. So you can actually also argue in this Boltzmann way for practical purposes. But it's not the truth.
Can you give me a little inspiration why this one plus this term?
Yeah, I can. So it's easy when you have this bubble sum. Yeah, so it's a geometric series. You can write this as 1 over 1 plus the bubble.
Yes, thank
and
you.
The bubble is t squared times k times n.
All right. That's
because it's actually
geometric series.
It's actually f rho. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's important. Thanks. Okay, so with this we are done. So what we predict is that there's a different scaling in the infrared. Once the occupation numbers, which will rise, yeah, from d minus 2/3, they will rise in the infrared. It should go over into a different scaling with d plus 2. And there's also a second solution. Now, all the rest will be told by us later on. So why we actually dare to come here to tell you this. Thanks a lot.